This week on Making Contact.
When machines and computers' profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, militarism, and economic exploitation are incapable of being conquered.
On April 4th, 1967, 1 year to the day before his assassination, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. made a major address on the Vietnam War at Riverside Church in New York. It was the first time King would tell the world why he opposed the war, saying that his conscience left him no other choice. We rarely hear about King's Beyond Vietnam speech in the mass media, and glossy retrospectives on network television often fast forward from his 1963 I Have a Dream speech in Washington to the Voting Rights Act victory of 1965 to the image of King dead on the balcony of a Memphis motel in 1968. What about King's call for the United States to get on the right side of the world revolution? Or his denunciation of what he called the triple evils of racism, economic exploitation, and militarism? On this special edition of Making Contact, we take a look at Martin Luther King's stance against the Vietnam War and its relevance today. I'm Philip Babich, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. In the mid-1960s, two major social movements were underway in the United States. One, the civil rights movement, was reaching a crescendo, with civil and voting rights legislation becoming law. The other, the anti-Vietnam War movement, was just taking shape. It also was a time of domestic upheaval, as frustration among urban blacks spilled over into riots. The message of nonviolence, advocated by Martin Luther King and other civil rights leaders, seemed to be losing its appeal.
As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I have tried to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. For the sake of those boys, for the sake of this government, for the sake of the hundreds of thousands trembling under our violence, I cannot be silent. There's been a lot of applauding over the last few years. They've applauded our total movement. They've applauded me. America and most of its newspapers applauded me in Montgomery when I stood before thousands of Negroes getting ready to riot when my home was bombed and said, "We can't do it this way." They applauded us in the sit-in movement when we nonviolently decided to sit in at lunch counters. They applauded us on the freedom rides when we accepted blows without retaliation. They praised us in Albany and Birmingham and Selma, Alabama. Oh, the press was so noble in its applause and so noble in its praise when I was saying, "Be nonviolent toward Bull Connor." When I was saying, "Be nonviolent toward Jim Clark." There's something strangely inconsistent about a nation and a press that will praise you when you say, "Be nonviolent toward Jim Clark," but will curse and damn you when you say, "Be nonviolent toward little brown Vietnamese children." There's something wrong with that press.
It took King several years to arrive at his decision to speak out publicly against the war in Vietnam. There was no moral dilemma for King, say his advisors. He opposed U.S. aggression in Southeast Asia almost immediately. There were political considerations, and the question of how his opposition to the Vietnam War would affect the civil rights movement, which still had much work to accomplish. In 1965, the Fellowship of Reconciliation invited King to join an interfaith delegation to Vietnam to witness the destructiveness of the war. King declined and asked a close advisor of his, Reverend James Lawson, to go in his place.
Martin King decided that no matter his great interest in it and no matter his commitment to peace instead of the war, that as being Martin Luther King Jr. and in the forefront of the struggle and the symbol of the struggle for millions of people in the country, that he could not go on that interfaith team to see for themselves. So at that time, we talked at length about the struggle, and the key issue for him was that it was not the time. 1965 was the Selma to Montgomery March and the push to get the Voting Rights Bill through Congress. He was of the mind that this was not the right time at all for him to be able to leave the country for that length of time and to make that kind of statement to the world.
Another concern for King, says Claiborne Carson, professor of history at Stanford University and director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Papers Project, was the likelihood of losing support from President Lyndon Johnson.
King strongly supported what Lyndon Johnson was doing domestically. Certainly, he had been at the signing of the Voting Rights Act in 1965, and he had seen Lyndon Johnson put forward the Great Society legislation. And so, on the one hand, he felt the need to back that, and he knew that if he wanted to push more strongly for to expand this kind of anti-poverty legislation, he needed to have access to the White House. And I think he knew enough about Lyndon Johnson to know that the moment he took a stand on the Vietnam War, his access to the White House would end, and as it did.
By 1967, King could see that the war itself was hurting the fight against poverty. On April 4th of that year, at Riverside Church in New York, King broke his silence, citing as one of his major reasons the buildup in Vietnam and its impact on the government's poverty program. He said that a few years prior, it seemed as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor, both black and white.
Then came the buildup in Vietnam. And I watched this program broken and eviscerated as if it was some idle political plaything of a society gone mad on war. And I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor so long as adventures like Vietnam continued to draw men and skills and money like some demonic destructive suction tube. So I was increasingly compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor and to attack it as such. Perhaps a more tragic recognition of reality took place, and it became clear to me that the war was doing far more than devastating the hopes of the poor at home. It was sending their sons and their brothers and their husbands to fight and to die in extraordinarily high proportions relative to the rest of the population. We were taking the black young men who had been crippled by our society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia and East Holland. So we have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony, watching Negro and white boys on TV screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schools. So we watch them in brutal solidarity, burning the huts of a poor village, but we realized that they would hardly live on the same block in Chicago. I cannot be silent in the face of such cruel manipulation of the poor.
This brutal solidarity ended at the gates of a graveyard for at least one dead black soldier who returned from Vietnam, recalls Gwen Patton, archivist of the Montgomery Pioneer Voting Rights Activists at Trenholm State Technical College in Montgomery, Alabama. The town's black graveyard was full, so the body was taken to the white cemetery, but the whites wouldn't allow the burial to take place. Eventually, says Patton, the black soldier's body was buried in Montgomery. She says discrimination against black veterans didn't end there.
And then you had veterans, Vietnam veterans, coming back, still not being able to register to vote at that time. Though the poll tax was lifted, because that was an executive order under Roosevelt during World War II, soldiers didn't have to pay poll taxes, but they still had to take the literacy test. The so-called literacy test, which was nothing but a barrier, a racist barrier. And then, of course, the registrar had all power. So even when you did pass the so-called literacy test, the recalcitrant registrar, depending on his or her racist mood for that day, would just simply deny. So you had all of those kinds of contradictions, and they also had an impact, I think, on Dr. King.
King synthesized the goals of civil rights and economic justice with an anti-war message, saying that the struggle was won against the three evils of racism, economic exploitation, and militarism. In his Riverside speech, King said that, quote, the war in Vietnam was but a symptom of a far deeper malady within the American spirit, and he called for a revolution of values.
A true revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth with righteous indignation. It will look across the seas and see individual capitalists of the West investing huge sums of money in Asia, Africa, and South America, only to take the profits out with no concern for the social betterment of the countries and say this is not just. It will look at our alliance with the landed gentry of South America and say, this is not just. Western arrogance of feeling that it has everything to teach others and nothing to learn from them is not just. A true revolution of values will lay hand on the world order and say of war, this way of settling differences is not just. This business of burning human beings with napalm, filling our nation's homes with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of peoples normally humane, of sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense and on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information about the subject of this week's program, please give us a call. It's toll-free, 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for a cassette or CD copy of this program. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. That's radioproject.org. Up until a speech at Riverside Church, the establishment press had been a valuable ally of King's, says Jeff Cohen, founder of the Media Watch group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR.
All of a sudden, he's a totally different person. He's not someone you can trust. Time magazine referred to the Beyond Vietnam speech as, quote, demagogic slander that sounded like a script for Radio Hanoi. And then the Washington Post patronized that, quote, King has diminished his usefulness to his cause, his country, his people. They were against legalized segregation in the South, but they certainly were not with King on King's foreign policy. So you had, you know, King in speech after speech was saying that the Vietnam War was taking billions of tax dollars away from U.S. cities and the poor in our country. The phrase he used to say over and over, the war on poverty, said Martin Luther King, is being defeated on the battlefields of Vietnam. So it was this effort to link the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement that appalled the so-called liberal media. And here's what the New York Times lectured King, that Vietnam and racism are, quote, distinct and separate issues. And the Times went on that merging these two issues did a disservice to both and led to deeper confusion. I mean, this is the kind of patronizing rhetoric from the so-called liberal media, which really did turn strongly against Martin Luther King in 1967 and 8.
We were a little surprised at the intensity of the criticism, and we expected some waves, that the splash into that foreign policy would create some waves, but frankly, it was a little more intense than we thought.
Reverend Joseph Lowry co-founded with Martin Luther King the Southern Christian Leadership Conference.
The reaction sort of fortified our feeling that we were right, because we objected to the fact that part of the objection was racist. It was not only a political and philosophical difference of opinion, but it was racist in that there was some feeling that blacks didn't have any authority to deal with foreign policy. And we took strong exception to that, because we were among the first victims of a corrupt foreign policy, which was bringing slavery into this country. That was a corrupt foreign policy, and we were among the first victims. So we had every right to voice our feeling, because we had been victimized by a foreign policy that was immoral.
The sermon which I am preaching this morning, in a sense, is not the usual kind of sermon, but it is a sermon and an important subject nevertheless.
King was not deterred. A few weeks after the Riverside speech, he was back at his own church in Atlanta, Georgia, the Ebenezer Baptist Church, challenging the notion that U.S. troops were in Vietnam to liberate the Vietnamese people from communism.
They must see Americans as strange liberators. Do you realize that the Vietnamese people proclaimed their own independence in 1945? After a combined French and Japanese occupation. And incidentally, this was before the Communist Revolution in China. They were led by Ho Chi Minh. And this is a little known fact. And these people declared themselves independent in 1945. They quoted our Declaration of Independence in their document of freedom. And yet our government refused to recognize them. President Truman said they were not ready for independence. And so we fell victim as a nation at that time of the same deadly arrogance that has poisoned the international situation for all of these years.
In this sermon, King called on the young men of America who must make a choice on the draft to take a stand against the war.
Don't let anybody make you think that God chose America as his divine messianic force to be a sort of policeman of the whole world. God has a way of standing before the nations with judgment, and it seems that I can hear God saying to America, you are too arrogant. And if you don't change your ways, I will rise up and break the backbone of your power. And I'll place it in the hands of a nation that doesn't even know my name. Be still and know that I'm God. Men will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. And nations will not rise up against nations, neither shall they study war anymore. And I don't know about you, I ain't gonna study war no more.
Ain't gonna study war no more.
We're gonna lay down those bombs and guns down by the riverside way down.
In early December 2002, religious leaders organized a vigil and procession to oppose another U.S. war, one against Iraq. This participant said a climate of hate and fear in the United States plays into the hands of those who support war.
You need hate in order to cause fear, in order to create propaganda, that effective propaganda, in order to convince us to do what those in power want because it's financially lucrative for them. They need a situation where America is fearful and hateful, and they've got great grounds for it right now. And then the other half, there's a lot of people, I think, that are opposed to this. I think there's a lot more people that are opposed to this than we know, because a lot of people are afraid to talk about what they believe. One, because it's not fashionable to talk about politics in our work situations, on the street, in our homes even. And two, because of the Patriot Act and the current climate, and they don't want to offend their neighbors.
Tens of thousands of people have come out onto the streets across the United States to oppose war in Iraq. Kevin Gray, former managing editor of Black News, ran for governor of South Carolina on the Green Party ticket in 2002. He says that while he was on the campaign trail, he played speeches of Martin Luther King to help articulate a message of peace.
One of the tasks of the third party progressive candidate was to take on the peace message. And especially in a state like South Carolina, where it's pro-military, the home of Strom Thurmond, the Deep South, it seemed appropriate that we had to talk about the war here. And then the idea of racism, which formed the basis of Dr. King's thesis, the triple evils of racism, economic exploitation of the poor, and war going hand in hand. And those are the things that we had to address. And in that, this society would be a society that practiced those triple evils. Of course, we would have to protect our investments overseas with our military forces, such as we're seeing. What we're protecting is the privilege of a narrow group of people to maintain their dominance and control over the resources of another land. And the sheer hypocrisy of a country that is predicated on racial and economic unfairness, trying to preach or pretending that it represents that abroad. And that's the great hypocrisy that King talked about.
You know, we're clearly seeing social programs being cut as money is being funneled to this, you know, endless war that we seem to be engaged in, this war against terrorism.
Wendy Cooler is an organizer with the Montgomery Transportation Coalition in Alabama. She was the recipient of the King Spirit Award in 2001, an honor given to young activists working on social justice issues.
Ironically, America is a terrorist state. Terrorism is terrorism, no matter who might be doing it. And, the situation with Iraq specifically right now is a clear example of this. We've been murdering that country's children at the rate of 5,000 a month, according to UNICEF. That's ridiculous. The sanctions are ridiculous, and now we're talking about bombing them into oblivion if they fail to do what we ask them to do.
When we look around right now and we see all the rhetoric of war that is going on, all of the rhetoric of you do as I say or I will bomb the hell out of you, such as what the Bush administration has been putting forward, is the type of arrogance that Martin King was talking about.
Reverend Graylin Hagler is pastor at the Plymouth Congregational Church in Washington, D.C.
King had said in one of his speeches that
that he thought he could hear God saying that he would break the backbone of U.S. arrogance. I'm wondering, as a religious man, what is it, what message do you think God has for the United States these days?
Well, it's funny you should ask that. I've been preaching from Revelation as a series here at the church because it is that message that comes out of Revelation that John puts forth to another empire, and that empire being the empire of Rome, and basically points out the fact that no matter how high and mighty you think that you are, there are some things that you cannot control, and one of those things is really one's relationship in the world, and God always has a tendency to judge. And judge sometimes through other people and through other nations, and in that judgment will bring down those that are arrogant, those who are high and mighty, and those who feel that they don't have to listen to anyone or abide by any standard of basic human dignity. We got to remember that in time, every single empire that does not heed its a moral agenda of living harmonious and peaceful with other people will find themselves in a state of continual conflict, and finding themselves in a state of continual conflict will eventually crumble and fall.
We must face the sad fact that our government sought, in a real sense, to sabotage the Geneva Accord. Well, after the French were defeated, it looked as if independence and land reform would come through the Geneva Agreement. But instead, the United States came and started supporting a man named D.M., who turned out to be one of the most ruthless dictators in the history of the world. Peasants watched as all this was presided over by United States influence, and then by increasing numbers of United States troops who came to help quell the insurgency that Diem's methods had aroused. And who are we supporting in Vietnam today? It's a man by the name of General Key, who fought with the French against his own people, and who said on one occasion that the greatest hero of his life is Hitler. This is who we are supporting in Vietnam today. Oh, our government and the press generally won't tell us these things, but God told me to tell you this morning. The truth must be told.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact, a look at Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in Opposing War. Thanks for listening. And special thanks to Claude Marx, Sue Englander, and the Martin Luther King Jr. Papers Project for research assistance. Recordings from Chicago were from Mike Steven. If you'd like more information about the subject of this week's program, or if you'd like to get in touch with any of our guests, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for a cassette or CD copy of the program. That's 800-529-5736. Peggy Law is founding director, associate producer Amy Pomerlo, women's desk director Lisa Rudman, office manager Rosalind Fay, associate manager Susanna Hines, senior advisor Norman Solomon, national producer David Barsamian, and I'm your host and managing producer Philip Babbage. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Until next time,